Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And the thing I want to talk about today are the ideas and intellectuals that developed from the Institute for Social Research at the Goethe University in Frankfurt, better known as the Frankfurt School. This was a wide range of theorists, intellectuals, and philosophers who attempted to address some of the most pressing questions of life really facing human beings in the 20th century. There have been few other institutions in the past 100 years that have had quite such an impact on 20th century thought. So this is why I wanted to address it today. The range and the quantity of ideas that poured forth from the Frankfurt School, it's probably too broad to go into today. So I want to look at a couple of key figures and then talk about some of the themes that really hold their arguments and ideas together. The school was established by a Marxist heir to an agricultural fortune, Felix Weil, who believed that he could create an institution which could marry together the various strands of Marxist thought, which in the early 20th century, really as a result of the internecine warfare on the left in the late 19th century and the chaos wrought by the Russian Revolution, were many and diverse. He thought that these could be brought together and synthesized into a new Marxist position that would perhaps bring about dramatic social change, not in the East but in the West. The first meeting of left academics from across Europe and left intellectuals from across Europe was deemed to be an immense success, and Weil thought, well, this is going to work. And so he began to invest large sums of money in 1922 in Germany into building an institute. And it's interesting to think of the context here. This is at a period of time where there has been a failed rising on the left that's been bloodily put down by the Weimar government in January 1919, and with the help of the Freikorps. There has been a coup attempt in 1920, and there would bomb the right, the Kapp Putsch, and the following year, in 1923, there'd be another coup attempt by the failed Munich Putsch by Hitler, which is again put down. So we're in a time of immense political polarisation and chaos and political violence. And we're also in a period of time where there is a profusion of, an explosion of new ideas about Germany. The Kaiser, having been swept away, has been replaced now by a democratic government, which is, whilst in some ways a pariah on the international scene, in other ways it's becoming far more integrated politically and diplomatically into the system of world governance than it has that Germany has ever been. The creation of a republic, event of a democratic revolution at the end of 1918, seems to have unleashed in Germany in the 1920s all manner of powerful cultural, creative and intellectual forces. Ideas about class, gender, sexuality are openly and vigorously debated. During the second half of the 1920s, Berlin becomes the cultural epicentre, really, of the world. A wide range of cultural luminaries make their way to Berlin. Photographers like Robert Capa, filmmakers like Billy Wilder. You have homegrown talents such as Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill. A whole range of artists such as Max Ernst, who create all sorts of challenging and controversial and in some ways very unpopular works of art criticising the Great War. Erich Maria Remarque, the writer of All Quiet on the Western Front. There's an immense amount of interest in Berlin from Hollywood. There is a flow of talent from Berlin to Hollywood and vice versa. And then there's also a kind of a very subversive side to Berlin. Christopher Isherwood, the gay British writer, wrote extensively about the seedier, darker side of Berlin, of prostitutes and cross-dressers and rent boys and the kind of forbidden sexualities that horrified people like Hitler. Hitler himself looked upon Berlin as this kind of corrupt and seedy place, somewhere that that needed to be kind of changed and ordered and rebuilt. And part of his views about creating Germania, this city of the future, which would have been, you know, his answer to ancient Rome, was to sweep away this unordered and, in his views, sexually depraved and racially and culturally compromised place, Berlin. So it's no wonder that you get a new institution developing that has initially kind of has Marxist foundations, but has develops a wider remit amongst its chief academics, who are looking to try to explain, really, this essentially the new world of the 20th century that Berlin and later the rest of the world, as they see it, appears to have found itself in. The intellectuals of the Berlin School had lived through, really, the Marxist or the communist moment in Europe at the end of the First World War, from 1918 to 1919, was the moment at which it became clear that once the Russian Revolution had happened in Europe, it wasn't going to be replicated in Western Europe. And the question begs itself, why had the working classes not done this? Why had the working classes not done something that appeared to be clearly in their interests? I mean, with the benefit of hindsight, we can argue that perhaps it wasn't in the interests of the working classes. But in the context, in the moment, that was not an idea that was particularly popular or well received. The feeling that many of the people at the Frankfurt School had was that the working classes had done something really to benefit those who ruled them. And the question as to why really, really baffled them. So one of Marx's key predictions that revolution would happen in Germany, or at least an advanced industrialised West European country, and certainly not in Russia, that part of the Marx view of history had not come true. And so now the task came upon the Frankfurt School to look through what in Marx worked and what didn't. And in this process, many of the Frankfurt School thinkers began to combine Marxist ideas with other ideas such as, for example, psychoanalysis, or later in the 1930s and 40s, existentialism. And many began to challenge the grand narratives, really, of the Enlightenment itself, the idea that mankind was on this upward trajectory from unreason to reason, from religion to science, that modernism would bring a level of technological sophistication and harmony and peace to all. These ideas that had been very popular before the First World War, the Frankfurt School now challenged and questioned, particularly as Hitler became increasingly popular in Germany. The intellectuals of the Frankfurt School, particularly Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer, both argued that what was taking place was a counter-enlightenment, an anti-enlightenment, that the tools of the Enlightenment, science and technological process, had actually provided mankind with means of derailing humanity from the utopia promised, and the Enlightenment itself had created the seeds of a new kind of barbarism. The First World War gave plenty of evidence for this, and at the end of the Second World War, Adorno looked to the Holocaust and to the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima. Now, Theodor Adorno is an interesting guy to look at, and he was one of a number of the Frankfurt Schoolers who went to America. Adorno, a Jewish, German Marxist intellectual, left Germany in 1934 quite wisely, and he found himself on sojourn in places like Oxford University in Los Angeles. He did pop back to Germany to see his parents periodically, but the Frankfurt School in its entirety eventually relocated itself to New York. Adorno was a composer by trade. As a young man, he had been able to listen to Stravinsky, to Hindemith, and to the great new modernist composers of the early 20th century. Again, people despised by Hitler, who thought that music should be classical and traditional. He saw that many of the great intellectual figures who he had viewed as being part of the left, people such as the sociologist Max Weber, for example, came out in support of the Kaiser's War in 1914, and there was a kind of a huge distrust from Adorno and from his contemporaries towards these intellectual figures, seeing them to be utterly compromised by this reactionary act. So very interesting similarities between that and the kind of the distrust that the 60s radicals in Germany in 1968 seemed to have for their elders and betters, supposedly. There seems to be this recurring theme within the German left. The writing that Adorno does eventually is that part of the philosophy of aesthetics. You know, he looks at how one can make sense of what we like, how one can make sense of what is good, what is bad culturally, what is good music, what is bad music, and he has a particular argument that, and this comes out in his book, The Culture Industry, which is 1955, I think, where he said that all music, any music that is of any value at all, should be oppositional. It should be hard to listen to. It should almost attack conventional bourgeois notions of what music is. He wrote that when he was in America. At the same time that Eric Fromm, if you listened to my podcast on Eric Fromm, Eric Fromm was writing The Sane Society, which was a critique of kind of post-war consumerist society and its general effects on our sanity. Adorno wrote The Culture Industry in a period.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It went in a period of a kind of unprecedented wealth and prosperity in America, and he looked at American consumerism and looked at American music, and he made a number of points. He said that American music was it existed in much the same way that kind of new American Cadillacs did. There was a surface level of interchangeability. American sort of pop songs and crooning songs at the time and barbershop quartets and all this sort of thing essentially had the same structure, but you could bolt different bits on, different oohs and ahs and different sounds on to make it appear to be a kind of a different song, but it wasn't. You're consuming the same thing over and over again. The idea that people like this, that people gain pleasures from this, was rather lost on Adorno. He seems to be in this kind of frenetic rant against American consumerism and mass culture. And the book The Culture Industry became one of the standards on the not just on the New Left, but in various the various emerging cultural studies discourses in the 60s and 70s. And it was one of the kind of the great cornerstones of the study of mass culture. It's still a very valid, very useful book. I mean, a lot of it, I would kind of tend to discount now. But in terms of its significance to the debate about what mass culture is and where it comes from and what it is about and why it exists and what it does, it is. It's a valuable book. At the same time, I think it was perhaps slightly earlier, an American sort of former Trotskyite anarchist and general kind and cultural thinker, a raging alcoholic and general kind of subversive countercultural figure, Dwight MacDonald, wrote about what he called mass culture. And he said that, you know, originally, back in the Middle Ages, culture was generated within communities. So culture was a kind of an organic product of, say, a village in medieval England or in medieval Germany or what have you. And it was the stories and the folk songs that were created in a fairly organic and authentic way to try to describe the world around around the people. He said that culture in the period of the Industrial Revolution was appropriated by essentially the capitalist classes, mass-produced and sold back to the people, so that publishing, the production of music, the creation of things like cinema and television now meant that there was a mass culture that was mass-produced for a mass audience. And this was really a product of the Industrial Revolution. And there were all sorts of notions implicit in there that culture was delivered in a top-down way, that people were simply recipients. And Adorno kind of suggests this as well, that people are essentially pliant recipients of culture. Later on, another contribution to the debate, probably the best one, is by a guy called John Fiske, who said that, well, that's not really what happens, is it? People are very discriminating, they're very selective when they watch TV programmes, the shows they like, shows they don't, they project all sorts of their own perspectives onto TV programmes, they interact with them, they switch them off, they change channel, they talk about them with their friends. And he said that culture is the thing that's created when the text meets the individual, which is an interestingly kind of Roland Barthesian sort of perspective, you know, that the age of the monolithic author is dead, Roland Barthes argued. And he said that ultimately a new text is created every time somebody reads a book. I simplify what he's arguing an awful lot. But he said that, you know, when person one reads, you know, The Hobbit, it is not the same reading that person two has, because they have their own sort of individual mental universes to bring to the text and to impose their own fantasies onto it and interact in different ways, find different bits interesting and create meaning. And that's perhaps one of the Roland Barthes and John Fiske have perhaps the most nuanced versions of kind of what cultural creation is all about. The other great kind of exile from Germany who really settled in America was Herbert Marcuse. And Herbert Marcuse's influence on the post-war left is perhaps more significant than any other member of the Frankfurt School. He wrote a book, The One-Dimensional Man, in 1964, which covered as many topics as Erich Fromm does in his various works, The Fear of Freedom and The Sane Society. It is a really extensive piece on mass society in general, because Marcuse looked at the development of Soviet society as well as the development of American capitalist consumerism. And he argues really that in both totalitarianist communism and in Western capitalism, there is very little space for the individual, for people to be multidimensional, to express themselves in all sorts of ways that are natural and authentic. When he was looking at Western capitalism, he was particularly interested in consumerism, advertising, and those aspects of Western culture. And he said, well, this generates false needs. You know, we're constantly told we need a new car, a new wristwatch, a new wife, a new house, a new this and a new that. And he said, that means that capitalism has to exist on an immense amount of waste. He said that the idea that capitalism is an efficient system is a total fantasy, because efficient systems don't create landfills full of rubbish, of stuff that people chuck away after a couple of years. And he said that false needs mean that we are enslaved, really, to, you know, we're constantly told that we need all this stuff in order to create, you know, in order to allow capitalism to and consumerism and manufacturing of products to continue turning over. But we don't, and it means that any other kind of intellectual or emotional pursuit is not possible, and it is essentially restricted and in many ways kind of punished within consumerist society. He said this is a kind of a form of soft totalitarianism, because our abilities to dissent, to have oppositional thoughts, to to be inquiring, to have critical thinking, are stifled. And they're not stifled by the state, by secret policemen waving truncheons. They're stifled by the television, by the power of consuming pleasures, to snuff out these kind of radical thoughts. He suggests that we should adopt a position called a great refusal, and to dissent from the norms of consumerist society, and that negative thinking was the only sort of alternative. By negative thinking, he meant that as a rejection of positivism. Positivism is really the idea of the Enlightenment, that we understand the world around us, we know about, you know, night and day, wet and cold, you know, light and dark, all these things, and therefore we can reason them, and that our critical faculties of reason and logic are enough to navigate the world perfectly, and thus will kind of lead humanity on this upward trajectory. And negative thinking really challenges that. It says, well, we can't do all that. We don't know all the answers that we don't have. We're not able to understand the world in that way, that we are quite irrational creatures, and that the Enlightenment is not the solution that it is posited to be. The negativism doesn't really present an alternative explanation. It just simply challenges the narrative of the Enlightenment. And he said we needed to really do that, to be dissenting in individuals. And that a kind of an existential revolution needed to take place within Western society. And this existential revolution needed to take place because a real revolution, a class revolution, wasn't going to happen. That the working classes had been perfectly assimilated into capitalist society and were loyal to it, enjoyed the benefits of it, or thought they did anyway, and were willing to fight to defend it, as many examples in the 20th century show. You know, you have the working America's working classes were the most enthusiastic supporters of Richard Nixon and the Vietnam War, for example, when you have predominantly kind of middle class intellectual dissenters. The appeal of Herbert Marcuse to the new left in the 1960s was immense, because they had by that point rejected Soviet communism as the solution, as the antidote that the old left had embraced during the 1930s and 40s. It had been proven itself to be as, you know, violent and corrupt as any of the worst despotisms of the 20th century. And so he embraced a new... he does what the Frankfurt School does. He selects aspects of Marxism, combines them with other radical and left philosophies, and created an argument that seemed to unite the various sort of radical aspects of the new left in the 60s, the anti-Vietnam War protests, the feminist movement, the Black Power movement, and it was one Dimensional Man was one of the books that not only it becomes massively influential amongst that group of essentially the counterculture in the 1960s, but it also becomes one of the kind of the platforms for post-60s, you know, 70s and 80s identity politics. So the development of the politics of gender, sexuality, and race. It's interesting these days that very little is said about Marcuse or Adorno or Erich Fromm or any of the other Frankfurt Schoolers on the left themselves. They seem to have moved away from these radical critiques rather a lot. Some of them are a bit redundant now, you might argue, but their importance and significance can't be ignored. One way you can always hear about them is to turn into the kind of the rabid world of Fox News, where Fox News commentators frequently mentioned the Frankfurt School as part of some kind of elaborate conspiracy theory. So it shows that on the in the fringes of the frothing right, these actually fairly mild-mannered German Marxist intellectuals still hold some boogeyman kind of power. Yes, the various kind of scribblers and ranters on the kind of obscurantist fringe of American libertarian right-wing discourse look at the immigration of the various members of the Frankfurt School who came to America in the 1930s and say, well, you know, this is where the rot set in, where these kind of un-American ideas seeped into our society. But anyway, I hope you found that interesting and stimulating, and I will catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.